Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, your weekly information, security news and current affairs show. My name's Patrick Gray. And yeah, of course, we are back after a little break. And because it's been a few weeks, we've got an extra long news segment for you all this week. And then we're going to jump right on into this week's sponsor interview with Sherrod DeGrippo, Director of Threat Research and Detection at Proofpoint. That's a fun interview. Proofpoint sees an absolute ton of emails, so they're in a really good position to talk about trends. Sherrod will be along a little bit later on to tell us that ransomware, at least as delivered via email, has, and I quote, basically evaporated. So that was pretty interesting. She'll also be talking a bit about some of Proofpoint's own research processes. That is a fun one, and it is coming up later. But first up, of course, it is time for a check of the security news headlines with our good friend Adam Boileau. And Adam, you know, went on holiday for a couple of weeks, and that was the cue for Russians everywhere, apparently.
Yeah, both of the bears, Cozy and Fancy, have been cranking it up and compromising all sorts of people. Big phishing campaigns fired against a number of organizations by Cozy Bear. And then we've seen some new tooling deployed by Fancy Bear, as well as, you know, new things coming up in Ukraine. Some new malware being deployed there by, let's face it, the Russians. Yeah, Russians are having a bit of an internet party.
Yeah, they sure are. I think it's kind of interesting that they kick things up again after the midterms, right? It's almost like, okay, that's done. Now we can go back as business as usual, and we haven't interfered with any elections.
Yeah, you do kind of get that impression that there was just so much, you know, focus on the elections, you know, on the midterms, that, you know, anything would be kind of interpreted as going after elections, even if it wasn't. And now that that's passed, yeah, it's, you know, time to, you know, get back to business. I'm sure there's lots of, you know, lots of tasking queued up that they've got to go and, you know, get the job done. And yeah, we've seen, you know, just, you know, a resurgence of Cozy Bear activity. The Cozy Bear stuff is interesting, I guess, because we haven't really seen them around quite so much, you know, since the 2 years ago election. They've kind of gone a little bit quiet, and now they're kind of back with, you know, not a lot of style, it seems, you know, just kind of spraying stuff all over the place, a big phishing campaign pretending to come from
a State Department official, I think.
Yeah, a person at the State Department, and actually, interestingly enough, dropping Cobalt Strike as their payload, which, you know, A, I guess, suggests that Cobalt Strike is certainly usable operationally. B, is going to ruin a lot of people's days, as, you know, detection of Cobalt Strike will get even worse or better, depending on, you know, which side of the team you're on. Yeah, and rather than using their own tools, just, you know, using presumably stolen off-the-shelf versions.
Now, they're not just on the internet. They're also in the courts. The DNC has been, you know, filed a lawsuit earlier this year against Russia, against the Russian government, against WikiLeaks, a few others. And Russia has filed a response in this one that is just fantastic. They're saying, we didn't do this, but even if we did, it would have been a military action. So, you know, we're immune from any effects of lawsuits like these. Ha, 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 bye, bye.
Yeah, pretty much. Just, you know, ha ha, screw you. What are you going to do about it, buddy? You know, come at me kind of thing. And yeah, I mean, obviously Russia is, you know, a master of playing this kind of game. And they're not afraid to, you know, just kind of show up and really thumb their nose at it. Which, you know, I guess you got to admire to a certain extent.
Well, it's not just, you know, it's not just official government organs, you know, responding in this way. We've seen, you know, another troll farm, I think, that got kicked off Facebook is now suing, saying that it's violating their free speech rights, which is kind of, you know, funny. They're just stirring shit up, basically.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny that they've taken their, you know, campaign, which was running on Facebook to try and sow discord and, you know, amongst the American heartland, and now they're doing it through the courts, challenging, you know, the fact that they got thrown off Facebook and saying, oh, well, you know, Facebook is censoring our right to free speech, you know, Russian propaganda firm's right to free speech on Facebook, which...
Yeah, this is the Federal, you know, Agency of News, which is the corporate twin of the Internet Research Agency, apparently.
Yeah, apparently they shared the same, until very recently, shared the same building, shared a bunch of the same staff, and yeah, like it's pretty comic, I suppose. But on the other hand, it's just kind of masterful trolling, because here they are in the news, you know, whipping up you know, free speech and, you know, getting a whole bunch of, you know, right-wing libertarians or whatever on their side and exactly sowing the exact sort of disinformation that, that they were, you know, paying good advertising dollars for, you know, 2 years ago. So, you know, masterful, really.
Masterful. And you did mention that some more stuff is kicking off in Ukraine. I mean, from the reports that we're looking at here, it looks like people in Ukraine are sort of a bit worried that this could be the activity that they're observing now could be the precursor to something major. And of course, you know, with NotPetya and other attacks, like with the Russians flicking the lights every now and then with ICS attacks, you know, that's something we might want to keep an eye on.
Yeah, I mean, obviously it's much more real in Ukraine, you know, given their experience with the Russians over the last couple of years. And yeah, them deploying new tooling and new things into that environment has got to be worrying there. I mean, that's not a, you know, it's certainly no joke for them. This particular one, it's called Pterodo, I guess. And one of the wrinkles it adds to analyzing it is it doesn't actually run unless you're on a Windows that's using a language from, you know, one of the ex-Soviet states. So, yeah, all of the automated sandboxes that happen to have everything running in English just won't see it, which, you know, I guess makes sense when you're targeting.
See, I'd pronounce that Pterodo, as in same as pterodactyl.
Actually, yeah, I guess that makes sense. Yeah,
moving on. And this was a story that I think went way too big when I was away, which is the US Cyber Command, you know, throwing samples at VirusTotal. Everyone was like, oh, this is such a big deal. They're like doxing APT campaigns. But I don't know, man. I don't see any difference between Symantec doing this versus Cyber Command doing it, really.
Yeah, I think you're right. It's not a huge deal. You know, I think people are hoping that they'll see, you know, a bunch of samples that are, you know, a little bit different. Obviously, you know, VirusTotal's value comes from having a really wide range of things in one place where you can go and look at it. And, you know, they will, I'm sure, you know, upload a bunch of stuff that, you know, perhaps we haven't seen elsewhere. There's some examples of that already in the early uploads. Their first submission had some parts of the Russian, like, LoJack malware. That people hadn't seen on the platform before, so that's useful. One of the criticisms, I guess, or, you know, people have been saying, oh, well, it's going to burn APT campaigns and, you know, therefore kind of improve their...
Oh, come on. Really? Which,
yeah, exactly.
Burning right? down ops is a way to improve ops? Like, that's a pretty weak argument.
Yeah, so, no, it did seem a little... A lot of people, I guess, had a lot of hand-wringing about it.
Yeah, no, that seems, but, that yeah, seems all a bit dumb, doesn't it?
In the end, you know, dropping tooling without all of the other... you know, parts of the operational, the other, you know, tools and tactics and, you know, the other aspects of operational use, you know, that aren't involved in just dropping the malware, you know, would, you know, if you were really trying to burn stuff down, you know, that would probably be more damaging to them. But yeah, I mean, overall, I guess it's part of this increased, you know, openness from the Western countries, you know, in exposing the cyber ops of other people as a way of kind of shining light on it and, you know, making it less easy to get away with.
Yeah, I mean, one thing that occurs to me is there would have been some pretty major changes to internal processes to allow this to happen, right? Because can you imagine going to a SIGINT or sort of cyber agency, you know, even 5 years ago and saying, hey, why don't you just give us some of those sweet samples? Like, it was never going to happen. So I imagine this was probably the result of some pretty serious changes internally.
I mean, can you imagine how many meetings there must have been? Like, I,
yeah.
You know, it pains me just thinking about
this. Was probably this feels like there was some. It was someone's pet project. We should be doing this, you know. And they finally got it ahead. So, well done to you, whoever you are.
Good job.
Good job. Now, look, another thing that happened while I was away from the mic is a lot of very funny BGP announcements.
Yeah, there was a whole bunch of shenanigans on the BGPs. One of the big ones was a network provider in Nigeria advertised a whole bunch of net blocks that belonged to Google and Cloudflare to their upstream, which happened to be China Telecom, who apparently aren't very good at filtering the old BGPs, and then re-announced it to a Russian ISP, and then it kind of propagated out to the backbone and ruined the Googles for a little while until everyone you know, figured out what was going on.
I mean, initially people were like, ah, Chinese attack. BGP, rah, and you know, then it sort of became clear that the most likely explanation here is it was a fat finger episode, very similar to when half of YouTube disappeared because some Pakistani ISP announced a more specific route that wound up, routing half of YouTube to a null interface on one of their boxes in Iraq in Pakistan because the Pakistani government had banned YouTube at that time.
Yeah, I mean, I think the main thing people need to keep in mind when looking at BGP snafus is if it was a malicious attack, they would probably try and engineer it so the traffic still actually got there. And if the BGP breaks a bunch of stuff, then more than likely it's just your average, you know, workaday ISP network engineer, you know, cocking something up, which appears to be what happened here. They screwed up some peering routes, announced them where they weren't supposed to, and then it propagated because of China Telecom's rubbish filtering. So pretty much situation normal, you know, for the internet, you know, for every time in the last, you know, 25 years.
Yeah, but we've got an interesting report here from The Age, the Melbourne newspaper, about some more interesting BGP announcements pertaining to a cybersecurity company, and they refer to it as a British headquartered cybersecurity company with offices in Australia. And, you know, I mean, I can think of multiple, you know, many, many of them. We've got NCC Group, we've got Context, like, and I'm thinking, wow, okay, that's pretty close. But then I think, you know, what are you going to get by rerouting their traffic? You would think that they would, that wouldn't be such a problem for those sorts of companies.
Yeah, I mean, this was an interesting story because, I mean, this is an example of a more targeted, you know, more specific, not clearly kind of not a snafu sort of thing. But yeah, then you have to ask kind of what for? And I mean, this is a thing that is pretty externally observable. You would presumably only do it if you had a clear plan of what you were going to do with it. And that bit's a little bit unclear. The targeting, as you say, is interesting. I mean, you know, obviously security companies, pentest firms, you know, are holders of all sorts of really interesting information and are a juicy target, much like, you know, managed security providers have been. I mean, pentest firms, absolutely a target as well.
But and they yeah, also I mean, seem, they also tend to be, you know, stuffed to the brim with really paranoid people who crypto a lot.
Well, yes, but many of them also have, you know, back office functions just like every other business, right? That provide a way in. I mean, you know, running a business like that has all sorts of problems that everyone else has as well. But yeah, I thought it was interesting, you know, looking at the response Google had to the one we just talked about, where Google said, well, look, in the end, everything's kind of encrypted anyway. So whilst it's a bad denial of service, you know, in terms of integrity of the information, you know, it's not actually that much of a big deal. And, you know, Google seems to be happy to say that. And you would certainly hope that the sorts of companies we're talking about here would be in the same position.
Sure, sure. Rob Joyce, of course, you know, NSA, senior NSA official who, you know, often publicly comments on things like that, which I think is a great thing. He fired off a tweet that reads, "I hope this latest fiasco of traffic rerouting through China is the wake-up call for all of us to get serious about addressing the massive and unacceptable vulnerability inherent in today's BGP routing architecture." I can dig that, right? But at the same time, I've seen presentations, and I'm talking like years ago, about what the approaches to solving this problem would look like. And it's kind of difficult to keep the internet open and flexible while actually introducing some sort of PKI over BGP, you know, like some sort of PKI control, because that's really how you'd address this, over BGP announcements. Do you know what I mean? You're sort of introducing a bit of a choke point. It's a hard problem. I think the reason we're here with such horrible BGP architecture is because no one's really found a way to fix it yet.
Yeah, I mean, it's in much the same boat as, you know, DNSSEC is, or, you know, opportunistic IPsec everywhere, where, you know, yes, we have the technical mechanisms to actually do this right, but lordy, lordy, is it hard to actually do in an operational running network. And, I mean, if anything, the DNSSEC one perhaps is harder because of the amount of stuff out in the edge of the network, but, I mean, you know, we've really struggled with that, and we're still struggling with PKI, BGP.
And all of these things would be easy if we turned the internet into some sort of fascist dictatorship, but then we've turned the internet into a fascist dictatorship.
Yes, of course. And that will only, you know, kind of further drive balkanization of the network, which we don't really want either. No. And yeah, we're, you know, we're stuck with
China will not accept these, you know, signed BGP announcements because they come from the, you know, the pigopolists in America, you know, like that's sort of where we could be going, right?
Yeah, and we certainly don't want that. And I mean, this is the, you know, it's kind of ironic in a way that the internet protocol started as a military network and then turned into such a free, open academic network. And now we're back into kind of, you know, militarization and nationalization and, you know, trying to secure against this kind of thing, which, you know, the architecture doesn't really like anymore.
No, no. Now, look, we're going to move on to, oh my God, been a bit of drama at Facebook lately, a whole bunch of media reports coming out that look quite terrible for Facebook. I, you know, for me, the most troubling part of all of this was allegations that Facebook was hiring a PR firm to smear people who are protesting them as being funded by George Soros, right? Like that's some sort of, you know, obviously it's a dog whistle about it all being a big global Jewish conspiracy or something. I don't know. But at the same time, they were also contacting the Anti-Defamation League to smear the same group as being anti-Semitic towards them. And you just think this is the most nasty way to run a public opinion campaign. You just think, what on earth were you thinking? And of course, you know, can open worms everywhere. A lot of claims being made about Facebook not taking things seriously, trying to delay reports, just lots of funny stuff going on. And Sheryl Sandberg is not coming out of this one looking particularly shiny.
Yeah, I mean, the reporting and the stories around it really have kind of either been, you know, this is actively, you know, kind of, what's the right word? I mean, I want to say malicious, but it's like that it's actively nasty on behalf of, you know, Facebook's most senior leadership, or they're kind of asleep at the wheel and don't know what their subsidiary, you know, people are doing, you know, on stuff that they really, really like kind of is
no,
their job
no,
to
I mean,
have
these,
a handle
these
on.
Stories are talking specifically about decisions made by the executive leadership. You know, this isn't like this got out of hand. You know, this is like they deliberately put this strategy into play. They deliberately tried to do X, Y, Z. But the point is like countless column inches in the last couple of weeks, particularly over the last week, pertaining to, you know, Facebook, Facebook's alleged misdeeds.
Yeah, I mean, it really doesn't look good. And I mean, Facebook, you know, has certainly had its share of PR problems over the last couple of years, and this is just absolutely making it worse for them. You know, seeing it back and forward like this in the media, and really having, you know, there's a great photo of Zuckerberg that the piece in the news list that people want to go look at. There's a great photo of Zuckerberg looking, you know, kind of tired.
Yeah, a little bit. You know, he doesn't look happy in that photo. That's for sure.
He really doesn't. He looks like a zombie.
Yeah, and Alex Stamos has weighed into this, as he does, writing a piece for the Washington Post.
Yeah, he's done a good kind of write-up of, you know, his parts in the story. I mean, part of the discussion was about whether or not the Facebook leadership had kind of either suppressed the investigation into Russian interference in the election through the Facebook platform, or had, you know, kind of resisted publication of the information. And Alex is, you know, kind of relates his part of the story where Sheryl Sandberg was kind of Sandberg was, you know, unhappy with the amount of candor he had expressed in discussing the investigation with the Facebook board, but also says that at no point was he actually constrained by leadership to not investigate at all.
I think what he's trying to say here is maybe some other reports have made a little bit too much of the fact that Sheryl Sandberg got angry with him. And he's like, well, come on, you know, executives, large company, it's a pretty high stakes game. And if you don't get yelled at, like, you know, what even is that?
Yeah, exactly. Why are you even in the office if you're not doing something, you know, worth yelling in either direction, whether it's good or bad.
Yeah. So that's it. So that's stuff people can follow up in this week's show notes. Oh, now look, moving to some tech news, and apparently there's a whole bunch of new speculative execution bugs affecting Intel. Yay!
Yeah, some researchers have been going through doing a, you know, fairly kind of thorough analysis of the Spectre and Meltdown style bugs. Kind of what they've done is they went through the existing bugs that have been found, categorized them based on their, you know, on the properties that make them different from each other, and then kind of built a table to examine which areas of the CPU had the similar properties that had not yet been explored for that style of bug. And then they went through that kind of list and went looking for new instances of Spectre and Meltdown style, you know, memory leaks or side channel, you know, speculative execution bugs. And yeah, found a whole bunch more. I'm not 100% clear reading them and reading the reporting so far, whether or not all of them are addressed by the existing mitigations.
You know, yeah, no, I mean, this is what I was going to ask you about, because it's like, okay, sure. And how much of this is just like, well, if you're running a cloud, you know, service, just make sure you get your own core.
Yeah, it's a little bit. Yeah, it is a little bit unclear, and obviously, it gets into really quite technical details of the microarchitecture of the CPUs across the various vendors, and because they've renamed all of the bugs to fit their taxonomy, it's actually like you really have to spend quite a lot of time reading their papers to get your head around how it all works together. Anyway,
yeah,
the answer is I'm also not clear which ones of these are, you know, kind of real in the sense that people are going to get shelled with them. Intel assert that the existing mitigations cover off all of these examples, but reading the material, I'm a little unclear also exactly how that is the case. So
yeah,
I kind of don't know, and that's, you know, You know, if you and I don't know, it doesn't make you wonder what everyone else is doing for their risk decision making. And
yeah,
as
it does.
As you say, maybe just bunging everything on a separate core, you know, not sharing hyperthreads with people, not sharing caches with people, you know, is the kind of defensive option. I mean, if you're a hosting provider, and especially if you're, you know, a really high profile one like Amazon or Google or an Azure, you know, you would have to be pretty worried about this. Because, I mean, even if we don't see it widespread, you know, targeted uses of this kind of bug could be really catastrophic for, you know, the perception of the cloud as well as the reality of the, you know, of data or access that gets, you know, actually hacked through it.
Julian Assange having a pretty bad time.
Yes, he certainly is. We saw initially some reporting that there was, you know, plans to charge Assange out of the Mueller investigation based on the data that was stolen from the Democratic National Committee being handed off to WikiLeaks to release, that he might face charges under the Espionage Act. And then there was a subsequent bit where some other, like, kind of entirely, I didn't exactly gather how it was related, some related case of a different person included in some court filing and discussing why that particular case ought to be sealed, I mentioned that there were specifically charges coming for Assange, and it just kind of leaked out by accident.
I think this was actually an application to keep these charges sealed, but where they screwed up is they actually cut and pasted from the charges themselves and forgot to redact his name. So, yeah, nice work there. And apparently this is a thing that happens, right? You do actually cut and paste here and there, but yeah, oops.
Yeah, that is a little bit oops. Assange's attorneys are claiming that no one's told them about it yet, but I imagine old mate in the Ecuadorian embassy is probably having a pretty bad day.
Well, as long as he stays in there, he can keep making the claim that he's been detained without charge. Now, look, you know, I mean, I've always said this on the show for years. I don't like Julian Assange. I didn't like him before it was cool to not like him, as you know. I was a Julian Assange disliking hipster, if you will. I was into it before you were. But at the same time, like, I'll be real curious to see what they actually try here. And of course, we don't know what sort of evidence they're going to bring forward. We don't even know what the charges are. But I will say this straight up, if they're just going to try to charge him with publishing documents as opposed to doing something, you know, clearly illegal during the collection of those of that material, then you know, I'm going to have a hard time believing that that's a good idea or worth it, you know.
Yeah, I mean, you would certainly expect that there would be charges that were more, you know, involved with enticing the material, or that he had some knowledge of exactly how it was acquired. Or,
well, I think there's another option here too, which is, you know, throughout all of the 2016 stuff, there would have been a point where he would have become aware, and for him to argue that he wasn't would kind of be not believable. So I'm wondering if he even needed to be explicitly told by the people who are submitting him this documentation, yes, we work for the Russian government, or whether or not the prosecution can make a case that, well, look, dude, you obviously knew that this was coming from the Russian government because only an idiot would think otherwise given information that we knew that you had. I don't know. I mean, you know, there's a lot of lawyers who listen to this podcast, so maybe they can write in and tell me, RIP my inbox. But yeah, I don't think it's necessarily the case that he's just going to be charged with publishing stuff. I think they might whack that on top, but I'm guessing the charge document's going to be pretty thick.
Yeah, I imagine they were going to probably throw quite a few, as many as they can, see what they can get to stick. I mean, you know, certainly it would seem to beg a belief that as the Guccifer persona fell apart, that he didn't, you know, kind of understand what was going on. I mean,
Yeah, he didn't stop at that point, right? And yes. And is it reasonable for him to argue that, you know, that he's just this fool who didn't realize? And I just, yeah, good luck with that. Now, look, speaking of WikiLeaks stuff in the courts, the guy who has been, you know, arrested and jailed, you know, pending trial over the Vault 7 leak, he's being charged with more stuff because apparently, like, this guy is a gun at getting cell phones into prison, and he's been talking about his case to his family and trying to get them to call, you know, get in contact with the media. The judge told him to stop. He kept going. More charges.
Yeah, no, he really does not seem to be, you know.
He's not a sensible man.
No, he's really not making good life choices there. Apparently, he had multiple cell phones in his cell and was accessing, I think the indictment or the charge said, like 13 different email and social media accounts, and was exchanging material that the court had specifically said he wasn't allowed to via encrypted mail from his cell, you know, over smuggled in cell phones, which, I mean, I guess I guess he knows how to arrange a smuggled cell phone in jail. I mean, that must be a useful skill, but yeah, not going well for him.
No, it is not. Great story here from Lorenzo over at Motherboard. You know, he's done some digging in the Italian courts and discovered that the Hacking Team breach investigation is dead and Phineas Fisher has gotten away with it. You know, I've long said that Phineas Fisher is not an individual. It is a group, and apparently a group with very bloody good OPSEC.
Yeah, there's not very many people whose OPSEC is you know, really up to this kind of scrutiny. But yeah, it seems like the Italian courts have basically said there are no more avenues to pursue. They've been down, you know, all of the insider or ex-insider.
Oh man, it's a great read this story, because you've got this situation where the company was trying to like throw ex-employees under the bus because they didn't like them, to the point where the court is even like, "What are you doing? Like, these people clearly had nothing to do with it." It's just a crazy story.
Yeah, no, it certainly is. And I, you know, I feel bad for the engineers that used to work at Hacking Team that then got, you know, kind of thrown under the bus by their ex-employer. They've all been exonerated by this process and can presumably get on with their lives a little bit. But yeah, I mean, the, you know, Phineas Fisher, you know, job well done, I guess, or the, you know, multiple jobs well done, depending on how many people were involved. And yeah, gotten away with it.
I mean, doesn't it feel to you like Phineas Fisher, group of very talented attackers with good OPSEC? I mean, what did I just describe?
Well, I mean, there's a few people that meet that set of requirements, but yeah. It's,
and they all carry government IDs, don't they? Who knows where Hacking Team's malware was showing up and why someone decided to burn them down? All I'm saying is that it's entirely possible this was an op against them, because they're not part of it. You know, I mean, who's you worry the Italian government's going to get you if you're a competent SIGINT agency? Like, I'm just saying, look, I know that sounds like a crazy conspiracy theory. I'm just floating it as a possibility. I don't think it's necessarily a likely one, but geez, I've maybe gone from thinking that from like 2% to maybe 30%.
Well, I mean, that's the nature of the cybers, though, isn't it? I mean, it could absolutely be one really competent person. It could be a group of hacktivists or vigilantes. It could be a nation state. It could be a competitor, right? I mean, we just, you know, it could be a dog, right? That's the joy of the cybers. We just don't
know.
Well,
whoever they are, they did it well, right?
Yeah.
So hat off to you, because Hacking Team, we're a pack of shitheads. So it's rare that we get to report on a breach that we're like, yay, that breach. That breach was awesome. Now, Bitcoin having a terrible time last couple of days. It has plunged down to, you know, around $4,000. But there's a lot of action now focusing. And look, this is something we've covered on the show before, looking at whether or not Tether and Bitfinex have been involved in price manipulation. You know, we did a podcast on that some months ago. Now we're in the situation where the US Department of Justice is investigating that same question. And indeed, they're curious to know whether or not Tether-related manipulation actually led to the huge spike in Bitcoin prices last year, which is that would be very interesting if the whole thing was just manipulated. Tether, of course, is a token that is supposed to be pegged to the US dollar. So, you know, you give this company $1, they give you a Tether token, and they say for every token they've issued, they have a dollar in the bank account. But when people say, okay, let's see your bank accounts, they say, squirrel. And, you know, we don't actually get to know that stuff. So, look, it's all we're going to find out, right? And it's just looking shonkier and shonkier. And, yeah, Bitcoin's on fire. And, yeah, it's wild.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people, I guess, have been pretty sus about whether or not Tether actually had that money and the relationship between Tether and Bitfinex and overall Bitcoin pricing. I mean, some of the research does seem to suggest that perhaps 50%, I think was the last one I read, 50% of the value of Bitcoin at its peak was a result of those kinds of you know, lined up with manipulations of the market by releasing Tether through Bitfinex, which, yeah, like I'm sure the Justice Department is going to be all over them.
I mean, I feel guilty for selling my Bitcoin at the top, because it meant some real person paid money for it, and now they don't have money.
Some hodler paid money for that. Yep. You've taken all of their savings and their grandma's credit cards and that kind of thing.
I think I said on Twitter, you know, we can now, you know, pack up the crypto market and go back to using Bitcoin for what it's good for, which is buying heroin from poorly configured and trivially unmasked Tor Onion services. I think that's about where it's going to go. Look, another story on Motherboard, this one by Joe Cox, is really talking about how millions of people are owning themselves by installing malicious browser extensions. It really does feel like this has been a year in which malicious browser extension activity has accelerated. And I think, you know, we're increasingly talking about supply chain stuff, and this is the most glaring problem, I think, facing just average internet users at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, I think I agree with you, because the, you know, the browsers have gotten a lot better. I mean, it used to be it was always, you know, Flash and PDF plugins in the browser.
Yeah, you'll hear. I mean, I've got an interview coming up next with Sherrod DeGrippo from Proofpoint. And, you know, one thing I say in that interview is, like, you know, back in the day, like, you wouldn't even run Internet Explorer. It was like pointing a gun at your head and pulling the trigger because it was so vulnerable, right? And those days are gone.
Yeah, they are long gone. And, of course, that does mean that the attackers do have to go elsewhere to try and get their shells. And, yeah, browser extensions, have been, you know, a place that's been a big uptick. And we've covered a bunch of times over the last couple of years, you know, stories of you know, extension manufacturers or extension authors, you know, either having their accounts compromised or having them bought out, you know, for marketing, you know, marketing dollars or something that then turns out to just be you know, someone else putting backdoors in their code. You know, Google's done a bunch of work on the Chrome store, but it's still kind of a trash fire compared to, well, not having a web store, I guess, is where I'm heading with that. But, yeah, I mean, you know, people do need to be a lot more aware of what those extensions do. And, I fear for the day that one of the really big, you know, ad blockers, for example, it gets compromised in the supply chain, and then all of a sudden we've got, you know, 500 million Chrome users owned.
Yeah, that would not be great. The United States has a new agency, the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency. Trump has signed the bill that has established this new official federal cybersecurity agency, Adam.
Yeah, this is apparently lifts a bunch of the parts that were previously in the Department of Homeland Security under the National Protection and Programs Directorate, kind of lifts it up into its own separate government agency, still with some oversight from the DHS, but as a, you know, kind of a more visible, you know, higher priority, I guess, is what this is saying, part of the U.S. federal government, kind of in the same line as the FEMA, the emergency management people. So kind of up there, which, I mean, I think that's good. I mean, it's, you know, it is an important aspect, and it perhaps give them a little bit more tooth, a little bit more respect to try and, you know, push some of the processes and, you know, all of the hard work that needs to be done to secure, you know, what is a massive set of government infrastructure.
AWS introducing a new feature to prevent S3 data leaks. You know, what does this feature look like? I mean, first of all, people have to turn it on, right? So no one's going to. Lol. But does it actually look like it's, you know, useful?
Yeah, so I mean, this is a control that Amazon's added to allow you to add a master setting for S3 buckets. So you can say, by default, all S3 buckets are not public in your account.
And this is a new feature.
I know, right? So, I mean, previously, really? you could see in the dashboard, you know, oh, these ones are public, and they had some auditing tools you could go through and do it, but obviously people weren't. You know, this lets you set a master policy for your account and then stop your developers from derping it up or installing, as we're increasingly seeing, installing third-party, you know, solutions into your AWS account through CloudFormation or whatever, and then those having insecure default permissions on their buckets or on their, you know, queues, yeah, or whatever other Amazon gubbins. So, yeah, I mean, good incremental step. And the challenge with AWS, of course, is for anyone who's used the web interface before, like, it's such a, you know, twisty-turny maze of options and screens and settings, and, you know, finding anything in there is super difficult from a UI perspective. And, you know, one more control in there, you know, is not going to solve the problems that people have, you know, with AWS as a platform.
Some researchers have been going at ATMs and have discovered that they're pretty much all awful and totally ownable.
Yeah, this is actually, it's quite a nice piece of research from this company called Positive Technologies, you know, where they've been through a number of ATMs from a few different vendors, NCR, Diebold Nixdorf, and GRG Banking, and, you know, kind of looked at them holistically and done a bunch of, you know, penetration testing against them and reported on the results. Now, most of these attacks are not things that are going to surprise anyone. You know, some of it's physical intrusion into the ATM casing, some of it's, you know, intrusion onto the wire on the back all doing man-in-the-middle attacks, some of it's the fact there's not TLS validation talking to the payment switch, all the sorts of things you would expect. But one of the things I liked about this paper is that it's clearly written, you know, to be presented to a bank somewhere, you know, and it's explained, you know, in a way that is quite, you know, bank business model centric, explaining how much, you know, how the theft works, how long it's going to take, what resources are required. So, I mean, it's, whilst it's not anything technically crazy and new, I mean, we're not seeing.
It's just,
you know,
a good document, and you can throw it at someone, and they'll be scared.
Yes, yeah, exactly. So I think anyone who does, you know, any pen testers who listen who do work for banks on ATMs, it's certainly worth a read just to look at how well they've explained the material and, you know, just kind of cover off and make sure you're getting everything that you should.
Great bit of research here. Very happy to be talking about this one. Luke Janke, who's an Australian who works for Eltham Security, has come up with a gadget chain for owning Ruby apps via deserialization, and everyone's all very, very excited about this. You know, it's funny too, because I retweeted a link to this research a couple of weeks back and, you know, just no one really interacted with it. But, you know, you tweet jokes about Bitcoin and it's like, whoa, viral, right? So, but this is great stuff, and it kind of hasn't got that much attention, which I think is unfortunate.
Yeah, no, it was really good research and excellently written up as well. I mean, Eltham are a bunch of very smart cats.
Hello, Matt Jones. Hello,
yeah,
Luke.
Yeah, how you doing?
We love these guys. Eltham, yeah, Eltham are great people. Great.
Yeah. And, you know, it's great research. The blog write-up is really good. The guts of this is Luke's come up with a generic code exec gadget chain for Ruby deserialization. The previous work in the area was only for Ruby on Rails, which obviously has a significantly larger set of code loaded in memory that you can then use for gadgeting. He spent a lot of time clearly going through the Ruby standard library that's loaded in a base Ruby process and then figuring out how to turn that into a set of gadgets that turn into code exec. Absolutely worth the read if you're in the AppSec world. Deserialization is a wonderful bug class, and we've seen it used, you know, against, you know, Java and PHP and Python, all sorts of other things over the years. Ruby very much in the same boat. So yeah, definitely a read if that is your area.
Adobe ColdFusion causing some problems, surprise, surprise. But this time, like, people are actually using some serious ColdFusion bugs and doing APT things with them. But I've heard about these, man. Like, everyone's reversed these. Like, this story is like, oh, some APT people have reversed an Adobe patch to find this ColdFusion bug. But, like, I've spoken to quite a few people who've done the same thing. This is one you want to patch, people.
Yeah, the reporting on this was pretty funny because, I mean, the APT crew, you know, reversing, and I'm making air quotes here, reversing the patch for this, that's really not the fun bit of this story. The really fun bit of the story is this is Adobe reintroducing essentially a 10-year-old bug in ColdFusion. They replaced the rich text editor, FCK editor, which has been a historic sore point in everywhere that it's ever been deployed and has done, you know, has provided many, you know, generations of hackers with, you know, pre-auth arbitrary file upload. They replaced it with the fork CK editor, and it reintroduced the exact same file upload bug that they fixed in 2009.
Nice.
And that, I mean, there's nothing to reverse engineering. Like, literally, you post a file to it and then path traverse up and write a script, job done kind of thing. It's ludicrous and hilarious and wonderful.
Yeah, it is. I remember, you know, was it that time that ColdFusion was really on fire? Because there was a real bad run there for a while and ColdFusion boxes were just dropping like flies.
Yeah, well, I mean, ColdFusion's always been kind of an internet kick me sign. And I mean, this set of bugs against it, the like pre-auth file upload, were really the golden era of ColdFusion hacking. Although, obviously, there were many others as well. But yeah, I mean, this was the bug that got Melbourne IT owned, that resulted in the New York Times getting owned, that, you know, lots of high-profile stuff's been owned with pretty much exactly this bug 10 years ago, and here we are again.
Yeah. VirtualBox got OD'd, which, you know, I find it hard to feel sorry for Oracle when this happens to them, because they're such a bunch of crap lords.
They really are, yeah. And I agree. I mean, I use VirtualBox, and so, of course, I was super interested. I mean, in general, obviously, any virtualization guest to host exploit is always super interesting. And the write-up for this is just, you know, a really solid, super detailed. It's quite a complicated bug that the guy exploits. It's definitely worth the read if you're into that kind of technical exploitation. So, yeah, really, you know, top-notch bug. You know, obviously VirtualBox is not the most popular, you know, popular virtualization platform. It really is just, you know, kind of desktop and developer use. But, you know, there's still, it is used in the plumbing for a bunch of, you know, of tooling and automated sandboxes and that kind of thing. So, I mean, it is a significant bug, but of course, yeah, I mean, someone dropping OD on Oracle because they're sick of the industry. I mean, the guy was, you know, had some the usual sorts of complaints about bug bounties and full disclosure. Like, this is what's going to happen to Oracle, you know, when nobody likes them, is people will just drop bugs on them. And yeah, I mean, it sucks to be the users.
Yeah, it does. But there's a lesson in that, which is maybe don't buy Oracle products, right?
Well, there is certainly that. That is the primary takeaway from this. Do not buy an Oracle product. People who are never going to sponsor Risky Biz number 437.
Yeah, dude, they wrote to us a while back and were like, We're interested in sponsorship opportunities. I'm like, have you listened to the show? But anyway, Office 365 users and Azure users got locked out of their services because there was a multi-factor auth outage, which is an interesting way to get locked out of a service, right?
Yeah, it's not ideal. And obviously, you know, Microsoft did not do a great job of that. Having an outage of that is really bad. The fact that it didn't ruin the planet, you know, given how much stuff runs on Office 365 and Azure these days, I guess suggests how much multi-factor auth there isn't. Because if they'd broken single-factor auth, the planet would have ground to a halt.
Yes. I love it. You managed to find the cloud on the silver lining. That was wonderful, Adam. Absolutely wonderful. Certain things they just get wrong, right? Like Microsoft, they do so much cool stuff, and then you just read about something like this, and you're like, ugh. Or you see how crappy their mail filtering is, and you just, why? Why?
They did seem to suggest that they had rebooted some parts of their MFA auth infrastructure and things appeared to be working again. So good to see the troubleshooting at Microsoft headquarters is basically the same as every other Microsoft shop in the world. Let's just turn it off and on again. This is just not a thing that can happen in the as a service world, right? And you just got to do better.
Someone or some group out there is running around DOSing Cisco ASA appliances in the wild, which, you know, I mean, this is a – I mean, you could just write this story, keep it in the drawer, and every time it happens, just pull it out and run it again. But, not so great to be a Cisco ASA customer right now.
Yeah, and once again, I mean, actually, you joke about that, but honestly, this has got to be like the seventh or eighth set of bugs in the same protocol inspector. This is in this particular bug's in the protocol inspector for SIP, the voice over IP protocol. Like, how many of these bugs have been in that one module? Because I seem to remember a fair few.
And it's not the most complicated protocol either, really.
Well, so. I mean, it's got a lot going on. I mean, it's kind of HTTP over UDP in a way. But on the other hand, there's really good SIP fuzzing suites, right? I mean, we know Cisco used the Protoss and whatever the commercial codenomicon. One of those. We know that they use it. What are you doing?
Yeah. I saw too that there was another story. I pulled it out. I can't remember why, but another bunch of like default creds, like some debugging account that they've stripped out, and there's been like seven of them this year or something. It's funny, man. But, you know, at least they're finding them on their own, right? Catalin Kimpanu over at ZDNet kind of wrote that up. He was a little bit sympathetic towards Cisco. He's like, look, they've got to find these things, report them, not freak out their customers and not scare shareholders, and they're doing what they can. So I think maybe someone's been in his ear, but they're trying, right?
Oh, bless, I guess. Bless them.
Finally, Adam, one for listeners to read in their own time. The New York Times has a great story about Grand Theft Auto cheat software and, and company moves against the people who are selling this stuff. I just found it a really fun read. What did you think?
Yeah, I thought it was an interesting read. I mean, kind of the intersection between, you know, this kind of cheating and software manipulation and copyright and terms of service and, you know, national boundaries is an area where we're just not very good. And you know, for example, in New Zealand, this would absolutely be a criminal act, despite the fact that the copyright aspects would probably be civil otherwise. But if you do it with a computer, it's somehow criminal because different, you know, computer crime laws rather than regular copyright or, you know, kind of civil terms and conditions stuff would apply. So, yeah, it's an interesting place where these things combine in a way that, you know, I'm sure the people who are selling, you know, mods or cheats for games probably didn't really think they were going to get their house raided over.
Yeah, and this guy, like, what's his name? Christopher Anderson. He's from Melbourne and, you know, got his door kicked in sort of thing. And, I don't think he was expecting that.
Yeah, and apparently got his neighbor's door kicked in as well because he'd shipped an Amazon package to next door, you know, either by mistake or on purpose perhaps. I'm sure he's not popular in the neighborhood.
But yeah, it is an interesting read about, you know, copyright law, game cheating. Like, is it fair even to sell these sorts of cheats? And well, you know, I'd probably say no. But does that mean that they should up their investment in anti-cheat or, you know, bash people's doors down? I don't know. I'm kind of thinking maybe spend a bit more money on anti-cheat. But Adam, that's actually it for this week's news. A nice little roundup of the stuff we missed over the last few weeks. Thanks a lot for joining us and we'll chat again soon.
Hey, well, thanks very much, Pat. And I'll talk to you next time.
That was Adam Boileau there with a look at the security news of the last few weeks. Okay, it is time for this week's sponsor interview now with Sherrod DeGrippo, Director of Threat Research and Detection at Proofpoint. Proofpoint, as I'm sure many of you know, is a very bloody large email security company. They do a bunch of filtering and reporting. They are very, very popular. And I can say that everyone I speak to who works there is very on top of their brief. Let's just put it that way. They've hit serious scale too. So, you know, I kind of think of Proofpoint as the world's largest email security department, instead of thinking of them as a typical security vendor. They're not just plugging in other people's scanners into some boxes in a rack or, you know, some cloud infrastructure and filtering that way. They do their own work. They do their own research. They're always trying to push things forward. Sherrod DeGrippo is Proofpoint's Director of Threat Research and Detection, and she joined me to talk about what Proofpoint has been seeing lately. And given just how much email they filter, they see an awful lot. So I started off by asking Sherrod what the least expected trend is at the moment that she's seeing, and here's what she had to say.
I think the number one thing that's counterintuitive is that ransomware has basically evaporated. Ransomware was the thing that was in the headlines for a really long time. People were talking about it on the news. There were scare pieces in mainstream media for a long time. But we've seen over the past couple of months, ransomware has really dropped off. And it's really the banking Trojans that have come to replace it. I probably attribute that to the fact that cryptocurrency is so difficult for the average consumer to use that the actor
people
sending
can't
ransomware,
pay because they can't figure it out.
Exactly. They weren't getting paid because it was just too hard for the people getting hit with it. And what we've seen instead is, again, back to cryptocurrency, they're bolting on these crypto miners to just about everything. So commodity banking Trojans, commodity rats and keyloggers and things that are pretty basic, crimeware type stuff. We're starting to see banking Trojans have cryptocurrency miners bolted onto them. So they steal the money out of the traditional bank account, and then they leave that crypto miner behind to keep mining the cryptocurrency.
And they're mining Dogecoin or Monero or whatever.
Yeah, the altcoins, as they like to call them, are pretty popular with some of the malware actors. Bitcoin's been abandoned a little bit, but they'll bolt on just about anything at this point.
That's interesting. Why do you think it is that people have sort of stepped back from Bitcoin a bit?
I imagine that it's just really difficult, and there's a prediction issue, right? So if you're asking for ransom in Bitcoin, then you have to understand that volatility and be careful, and you might be asking for something that they could never afford by the time they actually receive the ransom note. So it seems like the altcoins have been a little more popular.
Okay, that's kind of funny in a whole bunch of for a whole bunch of reasons, but we'll just leave that there for now. What else can you tell us about what's going on? It's interesting that you mentioned the ransomware thing, though, because a few months ago I had a guy from Cylance on who was saying, you know, that they'd noticed a noticeable sort of drop in ransomware, and then I had a bunch of other people contact me and say, "Well, we haven't seen that quite yet, but it seems like everybody's seeing that now, right?" So that's something you can absolutely confirm, is that ransomware has dropped off.
Absolutely, ransomware has dropped off, especially in terms of message volume. So the threats that we see primarily come through email as well as network data. That's where we have our biggest visibility on the threat landscape. Sending ransomware via email has just died. I mean, it just doesn't seem to be the...
Could there be other reasons behind that? Like some crews got arrested? I mean, there's always arrests. There's always takedowns. Maybe someone getting nervous. Because there's always like pretty heavy concentration of crews among a small number of people. Could there be an angle on that?
Maybe. I don't ever see correlations between arrests and actual volume. So we watch arrests pretty closely, and we don't typically see a correlation between arrests and drop-off in volume. I really think that the ransomware has gone away because collecting the money is too hard.
That is, again, very, very funny. Now, look, another thing that we wanted to speak about today is, you wanted to fill us in on you know, how Proofpoint makes its sausages, right? Take us inside for a look at some of the techniques you're using to do threat research. Like, what are the ones that you feel, interesting that you want to talk about?
Sure. So I think that Proofpoint is really interesting because we have such an incredible amount of data that we have visibility into. When we act as the email gateway, we're able to strip out attachments and URLs and do analysis on them in an automated way and then pass those over to humans. So we've really created pretty massive, heavily engineered sandboxing environments where we pass all of the attachments and URLs through. Those sandboxing environments have been kind of engineered within an inch of their life. We have people who spend their entire day just making sure that a piece of malware will execute, will talk, and then we don't just get forensics. We pull the full configuration, the full list of web injects out of a banking Trojan, the full C2 information, and we've been able to automate all of that so that we pass that intelligence off to our customers, but my threat research team is able to really take on only the hardest, weirdest, most crazy stuff that we see in a day. So most of the commodity stuff, we've been able to automate the analysis of that.
You almost just tune it out, don't you?
Yeah. And we try to.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like me doing a noise cancellation on a you know, podcast recording. Just select, you know, wipe that, please. Yeah.
Right. And you save your human skills for the toughest, most creative pieces of that. And that's really what we try to do.
What's something that you've seen that's been like genuinely diabolical lately? Something that, you know, just, you know, absolutely had everyone stumped.
So in terms of lures, the most horrible thing that I've seen, you know, at Proofpoint, we see email, and email has been leveraged for social engineering essentially at scale, right? So instead of trying to understand a system with open ports, look for a vulnerability, find the right exploit, apply the exploit, get into the network, they just send an email, they have the person click on it, and it happens, right? But you've got to get that click. And the thing that I find the most horrible is some of the social engineering lures. One of them that we saw recently was saying, purporting to be from a law firm, saying, hey, your wife has contacted us and she is contracted with us to prepare your divorce papers. And so if you want to see a copy of your divorce papers, click here and download and open this file. And so it's leveraging this horrible emotional fact of someone thinking they might be divorced, or if you're not married, thinking, oh, I want to check out somebody's divorce papers and getting
them to
download.
Well, those people deserve to get owned, right? So let's not feel too bad for them.
It's a little harsh. But yeah, I mean, they're really taking those emotional lures and leveraging them. We see a lot of leveraging of current events. So for example, the Game of Thrones season finale was one. When those episodes leaked on HBO, they were leveraging the idea that these had leaked. And if you want to see Game of Thrones episodes that haven't been aired, click here. Oh no, now you have a keylogger on.
You know, it's real interesting, but every time you're not the first person I've spoken to from Proofpoint who's, you know, quick to draw attention to some of the social eng stuff, because it really feels like, you know, just as general operating system security has improved, you know, just like social eng is, I mean, it's always been there, but it feels like it's just the way things are done now, right? At scale, at least, you know, if you're doing things at scale.
I think that's really true. And, you know, sometimes,
and it's hard to stop as well, even if you proof point, right? Even if you're seeing a lot of this stuff, if someone's, you know, being clever with it, it's kind of, you know, a few of them are going to slip through before you catch them.
Right. And people will do things, as we all know in security, people will do things that will blow your mind. So we do click tracking. And I've seen click tracking where a single individual has clicked a malware link 50 times. They're just desperate to get that malware on their machine. And it's just something where humans will always do the thing that is probably bad. And so protecting from that can get really, really hard. We've seen, for example, like LinkedIn and Salesforce have both had data breaches. And we've seen those databases of Salesforce, for example, used to send out social engineering saying, hey, I know your boss. Your boss is this name. I know you live in this city. I know this is your title. Well, I need you to help me with this particular issue or I'm going to sue your company. And so now they're able to kind of drill down on a single individual, a human person that they've done a little research on. And it's just so much easier than attacking a system. And in security, when we look at the landscape and people get kind of, you know, a little bleak with it, there's been a lot of breaches. We kind of assume they'll continue. I think the number one thing that we can claim as a victory in security is that we have done a great job securing systems. We really have. We've done a great job securing systems and securing software.
Maybe not groups of systems, though. I think that's the problem that we have at the moment.
There is a problem with that. And I think that, you know, there's edge cases here and there, but we've gotten our message through in a lot of ways. And now the humans are the easier target.
Yeah.
Systems aren't as easy as
look,
they
I mean,
to
it
be.
Wasn't so long ago. I mean, I've been reporting on InfoSec now for, God, 17 years. But, you know, it wasn't so long ago that, like, just, you know, running Internet Explorer was akin to, you know, putting the cyber gun against your temple and pulling the trigger, right? Like, it's just, that's not a problem so much anymore. You got to be unlucky. You know, you're unlucky if you're running like a fully patched Win 10 box with the latest browser. You're really unlucky if you're going to wind up with shells bouncing out of that thing, right?
Absolutely. And I think that that's, you know, if you've been doing this for a long time, people in security know we used to live, you know, CVE to CVE, watching those vulnerabilities in 0 days, just falling out, chasing them. I mean, there were years when things were really hard and you're getting woken up at night because there's a new 0 day.
There were years where, I mean, you know, what's amazing though, is like WannaCry and NotPetya. Do you know what I mean? Like that was
full like a flashback.
It was a throwback to like, that was welcome to 2002, basically, when you've got
like
all of these
a
like,
retro.
Yeah, these SQL database worms and like Nimda and Code Red and like that whole period, you know? So that was fun. But
It was like being in a time warp kind of, and it was the first time in a long time that we had seen something that was so heavily network-based, and it made you really appreciate that, hey, you know, the systems are still vulnerable, but we've kind of let our guard down a little bit in that way because the security has worked in a lot of ways.
And, you know, the difference between now and 2002 is that, you know, global logistics, for example, weren't quite so reliant on, you know, networked computers. So, you know, really, I guess, you know, we're talking about some internal process stuff now, but how do you deal with the social eng stuff? I'm guessing the best way to catch that is probably going to be identifying the groups that are pushing it at scale rather than looking at the individual messages. You're probably going to be looking at, you know, more the message metadata and spotting people who are spamming it. Is that the way it's done?
That's one of the first levels that we look at. Definitely static information coming off of both the message, the attachment, and the URL. So we're examining things statically first. And then that static examination determines the priority for going into an executing sandbox environment. So if we see something that looks kind of sketchy, then it gets a higher priority to go into full execution for sandbox for full forensics. Mm. If we can tell for sure that it's bad, then we actually can hold it back a little bit. Or if we can tell for sure that it's good, we can wait a little bit longer to sandbox it. The sandboxing environments are so good that they've really been able to give us everything that we need that we can provide either to customers or that we can use to dig down further. We do track actors really closely, and we track them by lots and lots of different indicators, but we focus on things like the domains they use, the C2s they use, lores, all of that kind of stuff. And a lot of them will hit verticals. So they'll choose a particular favorite vertical, whether it's hospitality or news media. We saw one actor, so Fin7, sometimes referred to as Carbonac, is pretty well known, sophisticated financial actor. We saw them hitting fast food last year really, really hard. So any kind of fast food restaurant you can imagine, they were slamming on them pretty hard, trying to get back doors to scrape credit card data. And then they started narrowing down from like burgers to taco kind of
That's
restaurants.
Funny.
And then they started hitting only chicken. So they were only hitting restaurants that were specializing in chicken or that chicken was in the name.
I mean, you can tell that's just because someone like in wherever has Googled American chicken fast food, right? And then bang, up comes the target list. Like that's what that says to me.
It seemed really arbitrary. And then they started hitting poultry producers. So they were actually going after the farms that raise the chickens that then sell those chickens to the chicken restaurants.
God.
And so we contacted one of those providers, one of those customers, and said, you know, what is this about? What's going on? They didn't really know. And then we saw that same actor targeting bars. So the places that you would order your, you know, if you need 100 Microsoft Office licenses, you go to this bar, you buy your licenses. They sell like one-use servers. So they started out hitting the fast food. They narrowed it down to the chicken restaurants. Then they started hitting the poultry producers. And then they started hitting the technology vendors that sell to those poultry producers. So they're trying to get in that supply chain anywhere they can.
That's, you know, I guess, you know, take down big chicken is the strategy and everything connected with it. Maybe someone really likes chickens and they, you know, they want to take down this horrible chicken murdering machine. It's interesting though, because, you know, you are painting the picture and, you know, it is the image that I've always had in my head of Proofpoint as sort of like being, you know, a giant email security department, right? Staffed with people who are working full time on doing stuff like building sandbox environments and threat hunting and all of that. I mean, that's a way to think of Proofpoint, isn't it? Is it like a, you know, an email security department for, you know, shared department for large companies all over the world.
Right. We see so much email and we spend a lot of time on it. And something I always think about is, for me, my personal email, I just don't get a lot of personal email. I don't send a lot of personal email. You know, my mom doesn't email me. And I think that she texts me, so she does communicate with
me. Okay, that's
good.
I was a bit worried there. Like, this isn't Dr. Phil, okay?
We've really moved away from using personal email. It's just not something that people desperately depend on. I mean, you get your Amazon shipping notifications and stuff, but email communications in the enterprise, that's something that people absolutely cannot let go of.
Yeah.
And, you know, you get 100 emails a day at work that really, really matter. You get maybe one on your personal email that matters. And I think that corporate email, people just can't let it go. It's important to the way people do business.
Well, it is, you know, and I, Google Wave did not win us away from email, and I don't know if that's fortunate or unfortunate. Who knows? Maybe in a parallel universe somewhere, everybody's using Google Wave, and the threat environment is different.
I'm wondering when it's going to happen. When will email finally go down? But it just hasn't happened yet.
Yeah, we'll see. All right, well, Sherrod DiGrippo, thank you very much for joining us to have a bit of a chat about what you're seeing in the threat landscape, and also, you know, give us a bit of an inside look into, you know, Proofpoint's overall general approach into tackling these problems. It's been very interesting and a lot of fun.
Thanks a lot, Patrick. Great to talk to you.
That was Sherrod DiGrippo there from Proofpoint. Big thanks to her for that. And that is it for this week's edition of the Risky Business Podcast. I'll be back in a few days with a soapbox edition of the show. But until then, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.